Who knows what?
So his son? Prompted Pine.
Lin and Wanda had Joe before Lin went to Vietnam. Hell, if I remember correctly, Lin was only 20 or so. I guess he couldn't have any more kids after his injury.
So when you went to visit Lin and Wanda, was there anyone else living with them?
Not that I ever saw. I mean, their trailer was real small. I'm sure you saw that for yourselves. Barely room for them and Joey when he lived with them.
Did they ever come into town or anything? Were they ever seen with someone who looks like the girl in the photo? Asked Blum.
Lin didn't really come into town. He was a rural postal carrier. Wanda did some sewing and cleaning for ladies and businesses here and there, but they kept to themselves. I knew Lin, but I can't say I really knew him, if you understand me. I don't think anybody did. The war, I think, messed with him, like it did a lot of men.
And his son, Joe?
He lived with them till he got married. And Joe was young, maybe 19. Oh, that was back in the 80s, I guess. Then he had his own little place not too far from them. He worked as a security guard at one of the big manufacturing plants we used to have near here, when they actually made stuff in America. Then after that closed, he started selling security systems and gadgets like that for companies and such. Made a pretty good living from what I understand.
His brow furrowed.
His wife was a strange one. Can't remember her name off the top of my head. She was into all sorts of crap. Voodoo, and I guess what you'd call holistic stuff. But she had a mean streak.
How do you mean?
Got called out to their place one time. Oh, this was over 20 years ago, if it was a day. Somebody had reported screams and such. Well, that sick woman had tied down a damn dog and was branding the thing all over. Poor cuss. I cut it loose and it went tearing away, barking its head off. Wrote her up for animal cruelty. But that was about all I could do.
He snapped his fingers.
Desiree, that was her name all right. Desiree Atkins. Anyway, I remember her looking at me with these eyes. Dead eyes, I call them. Nothing behind them. Chilled me to the bone. And I'm no scaredy cat, I can tell you that. I figured it was because of her condition.
Her condition? Said Pine. Realization spread over Roberts' lean features.
Hey, maybe that's how you got mixed up.
Mixed up?
See, it was Desiree that could never have kids. Something to do with a woman's issue. I know old Len and Wanda wanted themselves some grandbabies, but it wasn't to be.
Pine glanced at Blum again. It seemed both women were jumping ahead to an awful conclusion. Pine said, Mr. Roberts, could the girl in the photo, Becky, could she have been maybe adopted by Joe and Desiree? I mean, at first I thought she might have been Len and Wanda's daughter, but their ages would have been off to have a daughter that young. But Joe and Desiree would have been the right age, I'm thinking, if they were married in the 80s.
Well, it could be. I mean, I never heard of them having no kid, but they didn't come into town, just like Len and Wanda didn't.
But if they had a child, surely she would have gone to school, said Blum. Roberts shook his head.
Lots of folks homeschool their kids. They did back then, and they still do today.
So you're saying if Becky did live with them, that maybe no one else would know?
It's certainly possible. This is a big county land-wise, and there ain't that many people that live in it. You could go for miles without seeing another house. And with all the forests and such around here, the homes are tucked away. Not easy to get to and not easy to see from any road.
He eyed Pine with interest.
So where are you going with all this?
Apparently in an unexpected direction. You mentioned that Joe died.
That's right.
How?
Well, he was murdered.
What? Exclaimed Pine.
If memory serves me correctly, this was sometime in the late spring of 2002. Fortunately, we don't have too many murders around here, and the ones we do have tend to stick with you.
Were you the one to investigate it? She asked.
I did. Me and my senior deputy at the time.
Can you share any details?
I'll do my best, and what I can't tell you, they'll have files of at the sheriff's office.
He finished his coffee and settled back.
We got the call in the morning. Man's body was found near a road by a guy out walking his dogs, head bashed in, and a knife sticking out of his back. It was Joe. And it was obviously a murder, all right.
And where was Desiree?
Damn good question. She vanished. Never did find her. Now, we couldn't prove she did it, but I'm as sure of that as I am of anything. Why else would she have disappeared like that?
Did you find any evidence? Prints on the knife, signs of a struggle, anything back at their house? Anything to show how he got to where he died?
No prints on the knife. No tire marks to show a vehicle hadn't been there. He bled out where he was found. Ground was iron hard back then. You know how good old Georgia clay, like concrete. We went to the house. Couldn't find Desiree. No signs of forced entry. No signs of a struggle. We checked the closet, and while there were some women's clothes in there, she might have taken some and we wouldn't ever know it.
Any vehicles missing? Asked Pine.
Joe's pickup truck. It was found abandoned about 10 miles from here. We checked it for prints. There were two sets in there, Joe's and Desiree's, which was to be expected. Nobody else's.
Were there any signs of a third person living with them?
So you're really thinking this Becky person might have been living with Joe and Desiree?
I think it's possible. She was in that photo with the Atkinses a few years before Joe died.
So you think they had, what, adopted her or something?
It could be.
But there'd be paperwork on that. I mean, there's a legal process to go through.
Pointed out Roberts. Not if you do it illegally, countered Pine. Roberts stiffened.
What are we talking about here? That they were just dodging the law some? Or are you saying that this girl was maybe, what, held against her will?
I'll be candid with you, Mr. Roberts, because you've told us a lot we didn't know. She proceeded to tell him about Ito Vincenzo and Len Atkins being soldiers together, the checks that she had seen payable to the Atkinses and the correspondence, and about a girl being abducted by Ito and possibly taken to the Atkinses. She didn't tell him that the girl was her twin sister. He said slowly,
So let me just get this all straight. You thought this Ito character kidnapped this girl to give her to Atkins because Atkins saved his life in Nam. Only the child didn't end up going to Len, but to his son and Desiree.
That's right. Vincenzo might not have known that. All the info I found had the checks being made out to Len Atkins. Now, he might have given the money to his son, if Joe actually had the girl and was caring for her.
And the FBI is involved because kidnapping is a federal crime?
Right, said Pine, with a quick glance at Blum.
But this case is really old,
pointed out Roberts. I'm working it as a cold case. The Bureau does that from time to time.
Well, I wish I could be of more help.
No, you've been a big help. One more question. Can I see where Joe and Desiree lived?
I suppose so. There's a family living there now, but I know them. I can go over there with you if you want.
That would be great if it's not too much trouble.
I don't have anything else to do. Retirement sounds great till you realize there's not enough stuff to fill up your days. And it rankled me not to be able to solve Joe's murder. It cut his parents up hard.
Right. And they left town. But you don't know where they moved to?
No, we lost touch over the years.
Well, if we need to, we should be able to track them down. Shall we go? Roberts swiped an Atlanta Falcons ball cap off the side table and stood. Peering down at Rosie, he said,
Okay, girl, no belly rubs from strangers. And hold the fort down.
Chapter 73. On the drive over in Pine's rental, Roberts had phoned the couple who now lived in the house and explained what he wanted. They had readily agreed to the visit.
They are Pat and Hazel Simmons,
he explained.
They bought the place out of foreclosure. Got it for a song, I heard. This was obviously after Joe Atkins died and Desiree disappeared. Pat's a long-haul trucker. They've got two kids, both in high school.
So you're friends with them? Asked Blum. He nodded.
We go to the same gun range and church, and we both like to hunt and fish. And there just ain't that many people who live here, so most folks know each other. He's a good guy.
Later, they pulled up in front of a small house in the woods. Parked next to it was an enormous Kenworth sleeper cab tractor painted bright blue. Next to the truck was a small, red Kia crossover, and next to that, a Dodge pickup with a dented front fender.
The big one's Pat's ride. Nice. Like a little apartment inside. He's on the road a lot, but he's obviously home now.
Must be pretty hard for his wife with two teens, noted Blum.
Oh, Hazel keeps them in line, but they're both boys, so you're right, she has her hands full.
Pat Simmons answered the door and had them come into the small living room. It was neat and sparsely furnished. A 70-inch Sony TV hung on the wall, and Pine saw a glass-fronted gun cabinet with different models of rifles and shotguns and two handguns inside. Pat was short and chubby, with longish brown hair, and he wore a Kenworth ball cap. His beard was scruffy, and his eyes were a dull brown. Hazel Simmons came into the room wiping her hands on a towel. She had on black leggings with a long white t-shirt. She wore no shoes. She asked them if they wanted something to drink, but they all declined. Roberts introduced Pine and Blum, and they sat down.
So you're interested in the folks that used to live here?
Said Pat. Pine nodded. Joe and Desiree Atkins. Pat looked at Roberts.
Yeah, I remember that. Guy got murdered. Not in the house, but out in the woods.
Probably why we got the house so cheap, added Hazel. And it's really not close to anything, grocery stores or hospitals. Both our boys were born in the bedroom. They came too quick to get to the hospital. That must have been tough, said Blum. I did it twice. Never do it again, said Hazel, laughing. Pine said, after you moved in, did you find anything the Atkinses might have left behind? Pat shook his head.
Place was pretty well cleared out. Bank took the furniture and sold it, I guess, along with the personal effects. There were some pots and pans in the kitchen, some old clothes that they probably overlooked.
Do you still have the clothes?
Nah, they long since got donated or thrown in the trash.
Did you ever see anything to indicate that three people might have lived here, including a child? The couple looked at each other. Pat shook his head.
I didn't. But I wasn't around much after we moved in. As you can tell from that big-ass truck outside, I drive for a living.
Pine looked at Hazel. How about you? Hazel pursed her lips and rubbed her fingers together. I can't think of anything that stuck out. And it was a long time ago. The place needed a lot of TLC. It's only got two bedrooms, so the boys have to double up. But the previous owners didn't do a lot to keep the place up, I can tell you that. She suddenly looked up at Pine. You know, I do remember something. When we first moved in, there were these drawings on a wall in what's now the boys' bedroom. Pine tensed. What sort of drawings? They were like you would see a kid do. You know, stick figures. I had forgotten all about them. I painted over them. Do you remember anything else about them? Hazel mulled over this. Well, I do remember there were different scenes, I guess you'd call them. You know, the stick figures playing or sitting at a table. She smiled. In one drawing, they looked like they were drinking out of cups. And there were always two of them. Stick figures, I mean. And they had, well, they had long hair, so I guess they were girls. I remember that because back then we didn't have kids and I always wanted a girl. Didn't turn out that way.
Maybe they were having a tea party, said Pine quietly.
Hazel smiled again. That could be, sure. I used to have tea parties with my sisters and friends when I was little.
So maybe the little girl stayed in that bedroom?
It could be. By the time we got here, like Pat said, the furniture was gone. I guess you could check with the bank, but I suppose most of those folks are probably no longer there.
Pine looked out the window. Are there any other buildings on the grounds?
Other buildings?
Said Pat.
No, just the house. We don't even have a garage. I'm going to put in a carport, but haven't gotten around to it. This place wasn't a farm or anything, so there's no barn. There's the cave,
said a voice. They all looked up to see a tall, skinny teenage boy standing in the doorway. He had on baggy jeans, a Nike sweatshirt, and an auburn ball cap. His long hair hung out from under it. Hazel said, This is our youngest son, Kyle. What cave are you talking about, son?
It's about a half mile from here, in the woods. It's cut into a little knoll.
He eyed Pine.
Trey, that's my brother, and me found it when we were little. We used to play fort and keep some of our stuff there. You know, like a hideout. We would even sneak out and sleep in there.
Hazel said in a scolding tone, Kyle James Simmons sleeping in a cave? That's not safe. It could have fallen in on you and your brother, or a bear could have been in there.
No bear could have gotten in there.
Why?
Because it had a really thick door with a lock on it. Me and Trey thought maybe it was an old mine or something. I mean, there was stuff in there.
Pine said quickly, If it had a lock, how did you get in?
The padlock was on the ground. It was all busted and rusted, but the door was shut. When we opened it, it smelled all musty and stuff.
And you said there were things in it?
Oh, yeah.
Can you take us there? Kyle looked at his mom, who nodded and said, Just be careful.
I got a couple flashlights,
said Pat.
Can I come along, too?
Pine was already out of the room and didn't answer. Blum looked at him. Absolutely. Chapter 74. Kyle led the way to the cave. It seemed to Pine like 10 miles instead of a fraction of that. She could feel her heart racing, and she felt lightheaded. Calm the hell down, Atlee. It won't help Mercy if you drop dead from a stroke right now. They had to pull at some vines and push through some bushes that had grown up on the path they were heading along. Kyle explained.
We haven't come back here in a long time. Guess it kind of grew over.
Forcing their way through some more underbrush, they finally reached an old wooden door set into a small hill with ivy growing up all around it. There was an open and rusted padlock hanging from the clasp. Kyle said,
When we found this place, the door was busted open. We fixed it up and got a new padlock.
Pat Simmons looked it over.
I can't believe this. All the time we've been here and we never knew about this?
He eyed his son.
Why didn't you tell us?
He shrugged.
It was me and Trey's special place, Pops. Then when we stopped using it, we just sort of forgot about it, I guess.
Pine impatiently pushed past them and thrust the door open. She turned on her light and entered. The others followed as Pat Simmons used one of his flashlights to help illuminate the way and handed one to Roberts, who did the same. The space was small, maybe 10 by 10. As Pine ran her light over the room, she saw many things. An old table, some rickety chairs, boards on cement blocks for shelves, some empty glass jars, a cracked baseball bat, a rotted sweatshirt, and some old tennis shoes. The floor was made up of sections of plywood that must have been laid right on the dirt, because they were dark with rot. There was the sickly sweet smell of old vegetation and exposed red clay. The walls were the rock and dirt of the hill. Pine's light hit near the back of the room, and she froze. It was a small cot, though there were no covers on it, and the exposed mattress was old and rotted. She turned to Kyle.
Did you and your brother bring the furniture out here? And the bed?
Nope, that was already here. And those makeshift shelves. We found old cans of food and some water bottles. We used them for target practice with our .22s.
Pine moved around the space, examining every inch. She stopped and bent down near the bed. Her light hit on a chain that was coiled up under the bed. One end had an open clasp that could be locked with a key. The other end of the chain had been sunk so deeply into the rock wall that Pine could not pull it free. Blum came to stand next to her and eyed the chain. My God, she said quietly. Kyle joined them.
Yeah, that was here too. We thought maybe they kept a dog or some other animal in here.
Roberts came to stand on the other side of Pine and said quietly,
Or maybe the girl, Becky.
Pine didn't answer, because her light had fallen on something else.
It was hanging from a nail driven into the rock. She walked haltingly over to it.
Sally, it's been over 30 years since I've seen you.
Pine picked the doll up and gazed down at it.
This was Mercy's doll.
It was a twin of the one Pine had owned as a child. Her mother had been looking for it after Mercy had disappeared. At least someone who had known her parents in Andersonville, Georgia had told her that. Her mother had never mentioned it. Pine looked down at the large, soft eyes of the doll, whose name was Sally. Pine had named her doll Skeeter after the character in the Muppet Babies TV series. She had tried to get Mercy to name hers Scooter, because that had been the twin on the TV show. But Mercy wouldn't hear of it, because Scooter was a boy.
Pine's features crinkled at the memory, but then she felt like sobbing.
Kyle said,
"Yeah, that was kind of creepy. We thought about getting rid of it, but neither one of us wanted to touch it. It was pretty old and ratty."
Robert said,
"You think that belonged to the girl?"
Pine nodded but said nothing. Pat Simmons, who had overheard this, exclaimed,
"Wait a minute. Are you saying those people kept a little girl out here? What, like chained up and shit?"
"That's exactly what we think happened here," said Blum, watching Pine closely. Pine turned and looked at Roberts. "I'll take you up on the offer to get the file on Joe Atkins's murder, and anything you have on Desiree Atkins."
"Okay. It won't be much, I'm afraid."
"It will be more than I have now. How big were Joe and Desiree?"
"Not big. Joe was about 5'7", 150 pounds wet. Desiree was a petite thing, 5 feet, 90 pounds maybe."
Pine nodded. "Okay, does the sheriff's office have a forensics tech?"
"Oh yeah."
"I'd like prints and DNA samples taken from here. We can take samples from Kyle and his brother for elimination purposes."
"Do you have samples of the girl's DNA?"
said Roberts. Pine thought, "Yes, I do, because it's the same as mine." She nodded. "And any prints found here I'd like to match against Joe and Desiree, if you have those on file."
"We have Joe's for sure. I don't know about Desiree's."
"Okay." They left the cave with Pine reluctantly leaving Mercy's doll behind, because this was a crime scene now. But then she stopped and turned back to the door. "You said Joe Atkins was in the security business?" Roberts nodded.
"Yeah, he'd put together alarm packages, whatever you needed. Most folks around here don't even lock the doors, but most of his clients were businesses, so he'd put in surveillance cameras and..."
He broke off when Pine rushed back to the door and started ripping at the ivy that had grown up on the rock wall and around the door. "Agent Pine?" said Blum. Pine said, "Help me pull down this ivy." They all joined her and in short order had ripped enough of it away to reveal a small, decrepit surveillance camera mounted onto the rock wall and pointed at the door, with a cable snaking down the face of the wall and into the ground.
"Damn,"
said Roberts.
"He had this place under surveillance."
Pine eyed the cable. "And this was before everything went wireless. I think that cable may run all the way to the house."
"Well, let's find out,"
said Pat. Pine sprinted back to the house and the others followed. Chapter 75. They reached the house and searched the exterior all over for the other end of the cable. Kyle spotted it behind an overgrown bush. The others quickly joined him. Pine looked at the spot where the cable entered the house. "What room is that?" Kyle said.
"That's me and Trey's bedroom."
"I wonder if Atkins used that as a home office when he was here," said Blum. She added in a disgusted tone, "since they only needed the one bedroom, apparently, once the girl got too big to keep in that room." They rushed inside and Kyle led the way to the bedroom. It looked like the bedroom of a typical teenager, meaning there was junk piled everywhere. And there was a giant flat-screen TV set on a table with Xbox controllers set in front of it. "Where's your brother?" asked Pine.
"He works at a 7-Eleven.
She surveyed the room, eyeing the beds on either side. There were two windows in the room, and one faced the rear yard. "If I'm Atkins, I think I'd want to be constantly looking in the direction of that jail cell, because let's just call it what it is."
Robert stepped forward.
Okay, desk about here,
he said.
And if he was using cable back then, I bet he was also using a VCR with a videotape.
Blum said, you would think that if whoever the bank used to clean out the house had found a tape, they would have looked at it or turned it in. Maybe it was in a place they couldn't see, said Pine, staring at the floor. That carpet, was it here when you bought the house? Hazel Simmons had joined them and answered, no, it was hardwood floors. Made the room too cold. Pat added,
there's no concrete slab under the house. It's on raised footers with a crawl space under it.
Okay, if the desk was there, then we have two options. She glanced at the Simmonses. Can we take the carpet up and look under it? Pat said.
Hell yes, I'll help you.
They worked on both corners simultaneously. Pat got his section up first and was examining the flooring. Kyle reached down and started feeling around each of the boards.
Hey, one's loose here.
They rushed over, and with everyone helping, they soon worked free a section of the hardwood flooring. What was revealed, set inside a wooden cubby, was a Sony VCR. Kyle reached down and pulled it out.
Wow, never actually held one of these before.
Blum said, look, the cable is still attached. Pat pulled the cable free and said,
we can hook this up to the boys' TV over there. It has the connections in the back. I'll do it,
offered Kyle. He carried the VCR over to the table the TV was on and started working away. Within a minute, he had it all connected. He turned the power on and hit the eject button. Oh my God, said Blum. A tape is still in there. It has to be the last one that he put in there before he was killed. Let's hope it's still good, said Pine.
That cubby it was in looks well insulated,
said Pat.
We don't have the remote,
said Kyle.
But looks like I can work it from the VCR.
He turned the TV on, rewound the tape to the beginning, and hit the play button. They all stood there and watched. Pine felt herself getting lightheaded and realized it was because she was holding her breath. And then there was the door to the cave. Minutes went by and nothing happened. Then.
That's Joe Atkins,
said Roberts. Joe Atkins, wearing jeans and a flannel shirt with a baseball cap on his head, appeared. He held a shotgun. Then next to him appeared a small woman with long, dark hair and a brooding expression. She was carrying a tray of what looked to be food.
And that's Desiree,
said Roberts. Blum noted the date and timestamp that appeared at the bottom of the frame. May 31st, 2002, she read. Roberts said,
that's right. Joe's body was found the very next day.
Joe pounded on the door and called out,
get away from the door, Becky. Food's here.
Joe waited and then unlocked the door. He stepped back, readied the gun, and nodded at his wife. She cautiously opened the door and placed the tray on the floor and used her foot to slide it in. Then she slammed the door shut. Joe got the padlock back on just before something hit the door with a tremendous blow. It made Joe and Desiree jump back. Joe fell on his ass and dropped the gun. From inside the cave, they could hear peals of laughter. Joe scrambled to his feet and picked up his shotgun.
You cut that shit out, Becky. You do that next time, Desiree gonna add another mark to your hide. You got that?
The laughter died away. That's right, Rebecca, said Desiree in a subdued tone, as though she were on some sedative. We don't want that, do we? Marks on your hide. There was no response from behind the door. Pine thought she might be sick. Blum put an arm around her shoulders and whispered, Agent Pine, I am so sorry. Roberts looked at the pair curiously.
Hey,
said Kyle, whose gaze was still riveted on the TV screen.
Dude forgot to close the padlock.
Pine said, you're right. Can you fast forward this?
Yeah.
He hit a button and the video leapt forward. Pine watched the frames like she had never watched anything else before. Stop, she said. Kyle immediately hit the play button and the frame speed returned to normal. The door had just been hit by another blow, and then another, even more powerful one.
Why is she doing that?
Asked Pat.
She must know the padlock's on there.
Pine said. Stop the tape for a sec.
Kyle did so, and Pine looked at Pat Simmons. She knows he didn't close the padlock.
But how?
Said Pat. Because she'd been in that hellhole for years, and she knew every sound, and she didn't hear that sound that night.
Blum said, Do you think that's why she didn't jump out at them when the door opened?
She waited until he was putting the lock back on, but before he actually locked it, she hit the door to distract him.
I think that's exactly what she did, said Pine. And with that statement, she felt an immense sense of pride in both her sister's patience and her cunning. All those years a prisoner, and she had remained vigilant, just waiting for an opportunity.
Turn it back on, Kyle.
Kyle did so, and they watched as three more blows hit the door. Then, the fourth one was the charm. The open padlock flew free of the clasp, and the door swung open. And there, just like that, was Mercy Pine. Tall, lean, strong, filthy, dressed in rags, and looking quite... Pine had to admit it to herself. She looks... not in her right mind, and who the hell could blame her? Pine's hand shot out and hit the pause button, freezing Mercy's image. She was staring right at the camera. Pine thought she must have known where it was located. She took in every atom of her twin's appearance, trying to wind it all back to when they were six, and then carrying it forward once more to this person. Robert said,
Is that the person you're looking for, Agent Pine?
Pine didn't answer him right away. Her gaze kept searching. The eyes, the nose, the forehead. The body was of no help. It had changed too much. But then she leaned forward and gazed closely at something. It was the freckle on the nose. As a child, Mercy had told her twin that God had done that because she had come out first, and their mother needed a way to tell them apart. Pine straightened and nodded. Yes, it's her.
I never thought I would be able to say those words ever again.
Her head was filled with so many thoughts, some happy, some insanely sad, some that were threatening to tear her apart. In desperation, she hit the play button. Mercy came to life, looked around, and then dashed off to the right, heading toward the house and out of the camera's view. The tape kept running, and they all jumped when they heard the shot. Then screams, then another gunshot, then more screams. They couldn't make out who was screaming, and they had no way to know who was shooting, although Pine assumed it might be Joe Atkins. Then things grew silent, and the tape continued to run. But the only image on it was the busted door. Pine finally reached over, turned off the VCR, ejected the tape, and picked it up. Blum looked at her, lips trembling. At least she escaped. Pine wouldn't look at any of them. She said, Yeah, and then walked out. As she headed back to their car, Pine slowed so Blum could catch up to her. Roberts was on the front stoop thanking the Simonses for all their help.
That must have been terrible for you to see, Agent Pine.
I've been waiting almost my whole life to see Mercy. And she's alive. At least she was in 2002.
Yes, absolutely. That is a huge positive.
Pine stopped walking. Robert said that people reported hearing screams, and he found Desiree branding a dog.
Right, said Blum.
But dogs don't scream, Carol.
You mean?
That's what Joe meant when he threatened Mercy. Desiree would make marks on her hide again. They used the dog to cover that up when Roberts got there.
Those evil, evil people.
And Joe Atkins was murdered, and Desiree Atkins vanished. Blum stopped walking.
Wait a minute. What are you saying?
Seeing her in the photo, and now in the video? Mercy is taller than me, and weighed maybe 160 pounds, and none of it was fat. She looked lean and rock hard. The Atkinses were small. She was bigger than both of them.
Agent Pine, you can't mean. I mean, Carol, that it's possible that my sister escaped. They tried to stop her. We all heard the screams and gunshots. And she killed them. But where is Desiree's body if she was killed? Who knows? If she buried her, it could be anywhere. After all these years, there wouldn't be much left. But why bury Desiree and not Joe? She might not have had the opportunity. That is all speculation. I agree, but if it's not that, then it's something equally improbable. They started walking again. Blum said, "Well, if she did kill them, she had every right. I mean, that was her home, a cave for all those years. The abuse, the horror. I can't even imagine. I can't even contemplate." Ariel Castro in Cleveland, J.C. Duggard, Elizabeth Smart out in Utah. There have been lots of others. I just never thought my sister would be one of them. But why would they do that? They were given a child because they couldn't have one of their own. Why turn her into a prisoner? Mercy was old enough to know who she was and where she belonged. She might have resisted, tried to run away. They got scared that if she told the cops, they could get in trouble. And Desiree Voodoo Atkins, who brands helpless dogs, doesn't sound like your normal nurturing type. As the years went by and Mercy became an adult, they had to take more drastic measures, like that jail cell back there. And they knew if she ever got away, they were going to prison for a very long time. Do you think Leonard Atkins knew? They were in a photo with her. They could see how she looked. The wounds on her. The fact that she wouldn't even look at the camera. Yeah, they knew. And they didn't do a damn thing about it. And when their son was killed and Desiree went missing, they probably thought Desiree killed Joe and vanished with Mercy. Or else Mercy had killed them both and made a run for it. Either way, they wanted nothing to do with that. They ran away instead. "Disgusting," said Blum. "Just disgusting. After what they did, they don't deserve to be called human beings." They drove Roberts back to his house.
"I'll call the sheriff and tell him," said Roberts. "And I'll let him know you'll be by for the file."
"Thanks, Mr. Roberts."
"Agent Pine?"
"Yes."
"This isn't just a cold case for you, is it?"
"Why do you say that?"
"I was a cop a long time. Still got the nose for it. I saw how you were looking at that doll, for one thing, like you'd seen it before. And then with the video, well, it just seemed personal to you."
Pine sighed. "She's my sister, Mr. Roberts. She was kidnapped from her bed when we were little, and she's been missing for over 30 years now." He nodded, his expression one of sorrow.
"I thought I recognized your name. I remember the case, because we got a bolo on her. Mercy Pine, right?"
"Yes."
"I'm sorry."
"Thank you."
"But it seems like you've learned a lot here."
"I have. Now I just have to find her."
"You know, she might be."
"I do, Mr. Roberts. Maybe better than anyone. But I can't let it go. I have to know either way."
"I wish you luck then. I really do. Nobody deserves what we just saw, especially not a little girl."
"No," said Pine. "They don't." Chapter 76. The coldest of cases. Pine had the file on Joe Atkins's murder and the disappearance of his wife spread out on the bed in her motel room. The unofficial conclusion by the local cops was that Desiree had killed her husband and fled. They had no idea that another person was living with them, so that person was never a suspect. Not just a suspect. My sister. She had seen Mercy on the video. She was sure of that. But she now had another piece of evidence leaving no doubt. DNA could live a long time on certain surfaces, and there were many things in that cave that Pine had never touched that had come back as confirmed to be consistent with her DNA. Not mine, of course, but Mercy's. The file did not have much in it. The autopsy on Atkins showed that he had died from a knife wound that had severed his aorta. He had bled out.
but he also had severe blunt force trauma to his head. The trauma had clearly been done before he died. Beaten and then stabbed. The chain in the cave broken. The door busted. Mercy escaped. Captured on that video for all time. And, maybe during that escape, she had exacted her revenge on her captors. She knew where Joe Atkins was, 6 feet under. But where was Desiree? Where had Leonard and Wanda Atkins gone? Were they still alive? Should she try to find them? Deputy Sheriff Wilcox had listened patiently to Pine's speculation and information. He had provided her copies of the case file. He had looked at the video. He had even gone out to the cave to see it for himself. He had been intrigued by the possibility of another person present at the scene. He had been surprised that that person was Pine's twin. But he seemed to have no desire to pursue an investigation into the matter. And neither, he told Pine, did his boss, the sheriff. Wilcox had said,
"We're really not equipped to handle cold cases, and from what you said, seems to me that this Joe Atkins fella got what was coming to him."
Now she went outside where it was starting to rain. She drove to the one restaurant in the area, went inside and ordered a coffee. The rain picked up and she gazed out the window as it poured down. She sipped her drink and saw in the rain nothing positive. Not one damn thing. On the one hand, she had made tremendous strides in tracking down what had happened to her sister. Mercy had been abducted by Ito Vincenzo and given to the Atkinses, and then Len Atkins had passed her off to Joe and Desiree Atkins. At some point, Pine didn't know exactly when, Mercy had gone from the room in the house to a locked cave. As Pine sat there, her mind wandered deeper and deeper into terrifying thoughts. Instead of finding her sister alive and well, or at least being able to locate and identify her remains, she now had to contemplate the possibility that her sister had killed one and maybe two people and was out there somewhere doing God knew what. Pine knew that after her years of brutalization at the hands of the Atkinses, there was little possibility that she would even be able to recognize her sister, either physically or emotionally. She closed her eyes, and the image of her sister in that video returned to haunt her. Pine had had her sister with her every day of her life for 6+ years, and then for 30 years, nothing. Until now. And she could not reconcile the woman on that video with the little girly girl who loved her tea parties and stood up for her little sister whenever Pine had gotten in trouble. "I just want to find her. I want to help her. I want her to have the life she should have had." Her ringing phone was a grateful distraction. She didn't recognize the number, but she answered it anyway. "Hello?"
"Hey, Agent Pine, this is Darren Castor from Trenton. You talked to me about when I worked for Ito Vincenzo?"
"Yes, Mr. Castor. What can I do for you?"
"Well, you said to call you back if I remembered anything, and I do. See, I got my dates wrong."
Pine stiffened. "Excuse me? The dates wrong?"
"I told you that I started working for the auto body place in 2001.
"Yes."
"Well, I was wrong. I started working there in 2002, not 2001. It was during the first week of June. Should have known it wasn't 2001. I mean, 3 months later, 9/11 happened."
"You're sure?"
"Yep. I checked my pay stubs and some other records I'd kept around."
"You said the summer. Do you have a specific date? That would be really helpful."
"I do, as a matter of fact. The day he didn't show up was June 1st. I remember that because my wife's birthday is the 2nd of June."
"Birthday?"
"Well, hope that helps,"
said Castor. "What? Oh, yes, thank you very much, Mr. Castor. It was a big help." She clicked off and stared down at the phone. A terrible thought, a truly bizarre piece of speculation, was making the rounds in her head like a bullet caroming around. She called Blum. "We need to go see Jack Lineberry. Right now." Chapter 77. Pine drove fast and mostly in silence. She had not explained to Blum why they needed to see Lineberry. She could not bring herself to even say out loud what she was thinking. If it turned out to be true, It would be horrendous. Yet nothing will surprise me anymore.
She had called ahead and they were let in at the gate after identifying themselves. They drove up to the house and were surprised to be met by Lineberry at the front door. He was using a walker, but ambling around pretty well.
"You've made progress," said Blum.
"I feel much better,"
said Lineberry.
"I was just about to have some lunch if you'd like to join me."
Before Pine could say anything, Blum said,
"Well, I'm hungry."
They went to a glass-enclosed conservatory with views of the rear grounds, where the construction crew was now framing the cottage. They were finishing the fourth wall, and would probably start putting up the roof joists after that.
"I hope to never have another explosion at my house,"
said Lineberry, as he also looked out at the crew working away. Lunch was served by a maid in uniform and was delicious, though Pine hardly touched hers, something noted by both Blum and Lineberry. When Lineberry gave Blum a questioning glance, she shrugged. They finished their lunch and made their way to the library, where they had coffee in front of a crackling fire. A light rain had started to fall, and it was chilly outside. The warmth from the flames felt good.
"Have you found out any more information?"
said Lineberry.
"You were going to Taillefer."
Pine said, "We found out a lot, and none of it is good or pleasant to hear." Lineberry looked stricken at her blunt words. Blum glanced at Pine in surprise.
"My God, Mercy, she's not..."
"No, she's not dead. At least, that we know."
"What then?"
"She was held prisoner by a family in Taillefer. Not the Atkinses I mentioned to you, but his son and daughter-in-law." Lineberry leaned forward and put down his cup of coffee. He looked pale and distraught.
"Did you say held prisoner?"
"Yes. In a locked cave that I wouldn't let a dog live in. It was filthy, terrible, appalling." "Agent Pine," said Blum in a remonstrative tone, "Jack is still not well." Pine didn't appear to hear her. "She was living like an animal, Jack. No one to help her, no one to save her, so she ended up saving herself."
How do you mean?"
"I mean, she broke out of her chains, busted down the door of her prison, and tried to flee."
"Tried to flee?"
"This is obviously speculation on my part, but I think that as she was escaping, Joe Atkins caught up with her. Maybe he was going to try to bring her back. Maybe he was going to kill her." Pine was squeezing the wooden arm of her chair so tightly that her knuckles were red and her limbs were shaking. Blum observed this and said, "Agent Pine, are you all right?" Again, Pine did not seem to hear her. She kept her gaze on Lineberry. But Mercy turned the tables. She went after him. I can only imagine all the years of pent-up hatred she rightly had for him and what that couple had done to her. She beat him up, struck him so hard he had blunt force trauma to his head. She was big, taller than me, and she was strong. She would be a force to be reckoned with even if her strength hadn't been turbocharged by her emotions. Joe Atkins was a small man. She quickly overpowered him, took his knife, and... Lineberry was leaning so far out of his chair that he was in danger of toppling out of it.
"And what?"
he said in a hushed voice suffused with an underlying terror. "I think she stabbed him in the back, severed his aorta, and killed him," finished Pine. Lineberry fell back in his chair and started breathing heavily. Blum grabbed a glass off the sideboard, poured out water from a pitcher, and hurriedly carried it over to Lineberry. He drank half of it down and handed it back to her, thanking her with a look, though his features were still full of horror. Blum gave Pine an annoyed glance and sat back down. Pine continued, "I have no idea what happened to the wife, Desiree. She has been described to us as weird, and she has been observed to be violent toward animals. I have no doubt she was cruel to a staggering degree with Mercy. She branded her, Jack, like she was an animal."
"Oh my God!"
bellowed Lineberry.
"Agent Pine!" exclaimed Blum.
"She might have killed Desiree too, or the bitch saw the predicament she was in and just fled on her own. She would have gone to prison for her crimes against Mercy." Lineberry covered his face with his hands and muttered,
"My God, my God."
"Yes, my God,"
parroted Pine in a fierce voice. Lineberry uncovered his face and stared at her, realization spreading across his features.
Is there something else? Something you haven't told me?
Yes, Jack, there is. A definite something. There was a bite to the woman's words that made Blum glance sharply at her. Pine said, I got a call from a man who used to work for Ito Vincenzo. He had given me dates for when Vincenzo had gone missing. He went back and looked at some old pay stubs he'd kept and gave it some more thought. And it turns out, he was off by about a year. Ito didn't disappear in 2001. He vanished in 2002. And Castor was able to give me the exact day that Ito didn't show up for work. She paused here and studied Lineberry, who stared dully back at her. But there was something in the eyes that heralded the man had a premonition about where this might be going. Turns out, continued Pine, that Castor remembered because his wife's birthday is the day after Ito didn't show up at the store. She paused again. June 2nd. Blum exclaimed, but that's your birthday too. Pine kept her gaze on Lineberry. That's right. And on June 2nd, 2002, on my birthday, my father took his own life at his apartment in Virginia, not in Louisiana like my mother told me. And you were there, conveniently. And you identified the body for the police. Lineberry started to gum his lips like an elderly gent with no teeth might do. Pine leaned forward in her chair so that her face was maybe a foot from his. I want the truth, Jack, and I want it now, she barked. As though he were a snowman melting under a scorching sun, Lineberry collapsed against the upholstered chair and slumped down. He covered his face with his hands once more, but Pine pulled them away. Now, Jack. Lineberry sat up straighter, glanced at Blum, and then stared directly at Pine.
I didn't know the man who tried to kill your father that day was Ito Vincenzo. That I swear, and I still have no proof it was.
Wait a minute, said Blum sharply. What man who tried to kill him? I thought Tim Pine killed himself.
Pine said, That's what I was always told. By my mother. And by you, Jack. And you lied to me, just like she did.
What are you saying, Agent Pine? Said Blum. You can't mean.
I mean that Ito came to kill my father, and probably my mother, not knowing that they were separated. But my dad killed Ito instead. And Jack was there not by coincidence, but by plan. And he identified my father as the dead man. And with a probable suicide and a positive ID by a close friend and later the man's ex-wife, there would be a limited investigation. Pine stopped speaking and seemed to marshal herself. So now I know what happened to Ito. Now I want to know where my father is. Is he with my mother? She abandoned me while I was in college to go to him, right? He supposedly died on June 2nd. I went back to college in July of that same year because I was competing in weightlifting. When I got back in August, my mother was gone, and all she left was a note saying basically nothing. She paused, struggling mightily to retain her composure. Their divorce was a sham, wasn't it? They always planned on ending up together and leaving me. Pine had slowly stood, and her voice had risen along with her. Isn't that the truth, Jack? Lineberry looked up at her with a helpless expression. He said,
The divorce was a sham, but they separated to keep you safe.
Bullshit!
It's not bullshit, Atlee. It's the truth.
How would you know anything about the fucking truth?
I will tell you what you want to know, if you will just listen to me.
Please, Agent Pine, it's for the best. You need information, added Blum.
Pine slowly resumed her seat and waited expectantly, but every one of her limbs was still quivering with anger.
I didn't know where you and your family had gone when you all left Andersonville. We were frantic. We looked, but it was like you all had disappeared into a dark hole. And back then, there wasn't the internet or smartphones where everybody was taking photos and video of everyone else. People really could vanish.
And then? Said Pine.
And then, many years later, I got a frantic call out of the blue from your father.
How could he reach you?
I had given your parents a special number. It was one that I maintained all those years, just in the hopes that... Anyway, he told me he was in Virginia, and that a man had tried to kill him, only he had killed the man instead. A shotgun blast to the head.
If he was living in an apartment building, how come no one there heard it? Said Pine.
Because he wasn't living in an apartment building.
So that was another time you lied to me. Lineberry hurried on.
I flew there right away. The man's face was missing. I didn't know who it was, and Tim said he didn't either.
How could he not recognize Ito Vincenzo? Interjected Pine. He had fought the guy in Andersonville.
Over a decade before, Atlee. And people do change. Anyway, Tim told me he didn't recognize him, and I certainly couldn't have with the damage to his face. We hatched a plan that would substitute Tim for Ito, if it really was him. That way, the world would think Tim was dead.
So Ito Vincenzo is buried in my father's grave. And my mother? Pine added in a trembling voice. Lineberry broke off eye contact.
She understood what was at stake. She played along. That allowed your father and her to safely disappear.
And then she joined him a couple months later, said Pine bitterly, and left me by myself.
They thought it best. They thought you would be better off. I swear. She left you money to finish college and...
Pine barked. Where are they now?
I don't know.
Jack?
I don't know,
he said sharply.
That was by design. People kept tracking them down. There had to be a leak. At that point, no one was above suspicion, not even me. It was thought best that no one knew where they were going. I haven't seen them since then. No contact at all. None.
And I'm supposed to believe that, considering how often you've lied to me?
I can't make you trust me, Atlee. And I haven't earned that trust anyway. But I also didn't have to tell you what I just did.
So why did you?
Because you deserved it. You've earned it. And I'm tired of not telling you what you need to know.
His words didn't mollify her, but she sat back and tapped her fingers on the wood of the chair. She stared off for so long that she had almost forgotten that Blum and Lineberry were still in the room. Why do they need to keep running and hiding? Asked Blum. It's been, what, 30 years now? Is there anyone around who would still be after them, or even care? Lineberry shook his head.
I don't know, Carol. The Mafia has a long memory. But they've been on the run and off the grid for so long now, it's probably all they know anymore.
But they left me as a sitting duck, pointed out Pine. Ito took my sister and nearly killed me. So my parents run off and leave me to face the people coming after them?
I think they believed you were effectively off the radar by the time you were an adult,
said Lineberry. Ito found us? Who's to say someone else couldn't? She countered. It wasn't like they had changed my name. I was still Atlee Pine. How many of those are there?
I don't have a good answer for that. I really don't.
And you could have found me if you had really wanted to. I have my own Wikipedia page someone set up when I was competing for the Olympics. I became an FBI agent. My name appeared in the news from time to time. Lineberry wouldn't meet her eye.
I guess by then I had just stopped looking. And your father didn't tell me where you and your mother were when I went to help him.
Sure he didn't. Ignorance is bliss, right, Dad?
What will you do now?
Asked Lineberry, who was looking paler by the minute. Before answering, Pine stood. She looked down at the fragile Lineberry. I came here to find my sister. I'm a lot closer than I was, and now I'm going to do all I can to bring her home, even if you won't.
What are you saying? I want that too. She's your sister, but she's also my daughter,
said Lineberry. Oh, really? She snarled, her face contorted in fury. You don't give a shit about either one of us.
Atlee, of course I do,
he said, stunned by her reaction.
How could you say that?
Pine closed her eyes, and when she reopened them, she stared out the window at the cottage. Something seemed to occur to her, and she turned and stormed out.
Where is she going?
Said Lineberry. Blum said nothing. A minute later, they both saw Pine on the rear grounds, marching resolutely toward the cottage. Chapter 78. The rain was starting to fall more heavily as Pine neared the cottage construction site. There were 5 men framing away, 2 on ladders and 3 on the ground. She stopped in front of the cottage and called out, "All of you, leave now." The men glanced curiously at her, but continued to work. Pine pulled out her gun and her FBI shield and called out,
"FBI, everybody leave now."
Now the men all stopped what they were doing and looked at her, and then glanced at each other nervously. Pine knew they probably thought she was unhinged. And maybe I am. A large man in a construction hat gingerly headed over to Pine.
Ma'am, we got a job.
Pine pointed her gun at the sky and fired 2 shots.
Now!
She screamed. Some men scrambled down ladders. Others, on the ground, grabbed lunch coolers and coats, and they all hustled from the area, looking back at her with panicked gazes. Pine watched as they exited the rear gate, jumped into their trucks and cars, and sped off. Pine lifted her pants leg and took out her Beretta backup gun. She laid both guns on a wooden table, slipped off her jacket, placed it on the table, and placed a waterproof tarp over them. As the rain started to pick up even more, she stepped inside the shell of the cottage and looked at the wooden framing. She knew exactly why she was here. He took something from me. The truth. My truth. And now I'm going to take something from him. She spied a sledgehammer, picked it up, studied the configuration of the framing, and then lashed out and hit a king stud near the front doorway. The wood splintered. She hit it again, and the double boards broke free. She next took out the crippled studs underneath a window adjacent to the doorway and smashed out the sill plate. When she broke out a stud next to that, a portion of the framed panel gave way. Pine next took out a whole row of studs. She kept striking away at the wood until the entire wall broke loose and fell outward, landing in the grass. Pine wielded the hammer like a baseball bat as she attacked another section where the walls intersected. She swung away and splintered wood and ripped out nails that flew everywhere. The entire panel finally came crashing down, but with her last swing, the hammer's wooden handle splintered and then broke in half. The rain was pouring down now as the heavens completely opened up. Flipping her hair out of her eyes, Pine, her chest heaving with her exertions, approached the third section of wall, sized it up, and used a whip kick to crack a board on the lower section. Then she aimed higher and kicked 1 short board clear from the framing nails used to hold it in place. The metal of the nails looked like dead gray worms stuck in the wood that remained. She kicked at another board and then used an elbow strike on a sill plate to break it in half. A chop on another board took out a section of wall along with the window frame that it held. She tore out other parts of the framing using a series of kicks and hand and elbow strikes. The wall panel, uncoupled from the one next to it, was swaying now, and Pine repeatedly kicked at it as the rain streamed down and the wind howled. Her breaths were coming in gasps now. She then pushed and pushed and tugged and kicked, and with a scream of intensity, she finally managed to topple the wall. She turned to the last section standing and faced it like it was every nightmare she had ever endured, and she had more than most. Before she attacked it, Pine turned around and stared up at the house where Lineberry and Blum were watching her. Inside the room, Lineberry moaned.
I have to stop her. She'll hurt herself.
Blum firmly clenched his arm.
You will not stop her, she said sternly. She's your daughter, Jack Lineberry, and she needs to do this. And you are going to stand here and watch while she does.
Every muscle Pine had was twitching uncontrollably, like she was an addict going through withdrawal. She could barely see for the rain, and she had to keep pushing her hair out of her face. In exasperation, she looked around and spied a soaked cloth on the floor and used that to tie her hair back. She charged the last wall and slammed her shoulder into it. As the only wall remaining, it didn't have the support and thus the strength of the other 3 walls, but it also was not going down that easily.
For the next full minute, Pine kicked and punched and pulled and tugged, but she was far weaker now, so exhausted that her strikes were feeble. "You are not going to beat me!" She sat on her haunches, eyeing the wall like it had been the cause of every tragedy in her entire life. Pine couldn't even catch her breath anymore, and her limbs were shaking so badly she couldn't kick or punch if she wanted to. In desperation, she looked around, and her gaze finally alighted on what she needed. She staggered over and gripped the handles of the portable cement mixer. It was heavy duty and set on a pair of rubber wheels. She hoisted it by the handles, pointed it directly at the wall, and pushed off, slipping and sliding on the slickened floor, but gaining traction and speed as she went. The cement mixer hit the middle of the wall and drove right through it, taking Pine with it. They both sprawled outside. Pine lay face first on the ground and turned over in time to see the wall implode and tumble down. Her mission complete, she rose up on all fours and vomited. Then she collapsed to the wet grass and lay there for a few moments. She rolled over, stared up at the dark sky, and let the rain cover her like dirt in a grave. She slowly rose, sucking in deep breath after deep breath. She picked up her guns and put them back in their holsters. She put her jacket back on over her soaked clothes. She walked away without once looking back at the main house. She staggered out the rear gate and headed to the front. She spat out bits of vomit and rainwater as she walked. She pulled off the cloth tie around her hair, and it fell once more in her face. She knew she looked like a deranged walking nightmare, and she didn't give a crap. When she approached her rental car, she stopped and stared. Plum was in the driver's seat with the engine running and watching her expectantly. Pine started walking again and opened the passenger door. She gripped the top of the car roof and leaned forward into the opening. The crown of her head pointed at Plum, who just sat there and said nothing. Her belly heaving, her lungs gasping, Pine held on to the car's metal roof like it was her last tether to earth. She took one last deep, shuddering breath, and her tensed body relaxed. She lifted her head and looked at Blum. "Are you ready to go, Agent Pine?" Pine stripped off her soaked jacket and hurled it into the back seat. Without a word, she climbed in, shut the door, and clicked her harness into place. Blum put the car in gear, and they left that place behind and moved onward, which was the only place left for them to go. This has been a Shet Audio production of Daylight, written by David Baldacci, read by Brittany Presley and Keith Brewer, produced by Lisa Kahn, recorded by Jen Patton. Post-production by John Colucci. Daylight is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2020 by Columbus Rose Limited. Audio production copyright 2020 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.